Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 58 of NML Crossing, where, well, if you've been following my exploits and tales of woe of late, I don't want to leave you in the dark. I actually wound up buying a new dishwasher. Some pretty exciting stuff, right? Not really. I'm looking forward to getting it. It has a third row. I've never had a dishwasher with three rows, so I'm kind of excited to give that a whirl. Speaking of giving things a whirl, I have to admit that I've kind of been cheating on the show. I've been using some of my free time to do things that aren't related to the show, and of those things is trying to learn how to use Adobe Fresco to draw with. It doesn't actually have to be Adobe Fresco. It could be any digital drawing application. And I'm having a heck of a time because I'm an analog kind of guy. I mean, the fact that I can record audio onto a rig here and upload it is near miraculous, if you know me. So I'm trying to learn how to use these apps and stuff, and having a hell of a time finding really any good tutorials. The tutorials I'm finding, I'm using one of them e-learning apps. My wife has a membership to it for her business, so I just popped on to see what I could find, how I can learn how to use these apps here, because I'm the kind of guy who has, like, I was always kind of like the artsy kind of guy, so I would be gifted sketchbooks, sketch pads, you know, and I used to be able to work in a sketchbook when I was a kid, you know. Then I hit probably 16, 17, 18, and became deathly afraid of committing a single line of pencil to a sketchbook. I don't think anything I could do would even warrant, you know, the quality of a sketch or a doodle. So I don't, and I haven't. And sadly, with few exceptions, I haven't ever since. So you figure digital, there's no commitment there, right? You're writing, you undo, and it's all gone. You do whatever you can misshape things, you can adjust whatever you need to, you can change. I mean, you have a bevy of brushes, you know, you have all this stuff, all these bells and whistles. So I pop on trying to find a way to learn how to do it, because there's almost too much, you know. You're not bound by any sort of restrictions. The only restrictions are the ones you impose on yourself and your inability to be creative or your imagination taking a nap, you know? So here I am, you know, at the ripe old age or whatever the hell I am, looking at these videos, trying to get some sort of tips on how to use all the great things with, like, layers and masking and all that kind of stuff that'll really make things a little less difficult. And these videos I'm finding, oh my goodness. If you ever want to see, like, a 30-minute video, an art video, where 18 to 20 minutes of it is either feeding a cat, making tea, or watering plants with a tiny, tiny spray bottle, and then the rest of the video is fast-forwarded drawing, I can send you a lot of them. I can link you to a whole bunch that are just like that. And I tell you what, it is just so demoralizing. Like, I realize that I've wasted so much of my life. And you ain't gonna get your youth back. This is all stuff I should have known a long time ago. But yes, never bit the bullet. And here I am trying to, and I'm finding that I'm multiple generations behind, and tutorials or trainings or lectures are a lot different nowadays than they were back in my day, to make myself sound completely ancient. You figure you look up an art video and it's going to be, here's how you use this application, here's the tools, this is your toolbar, this is what each thing does. No, nay, we don't get that. We get petting and feeding cats for minutes on end, and then when it comes time to zoom in on the app, fast forward in banjo music. And the tiniest damn banjo music. Oh, it just makes your skin crawl. I don't know what world this is, but I suppose this is as good a time as any to jump back into our happy place here. The late 90s, the turn of the century here. We're going to hop back into no man's land. And we're going to wrap up our Bread and Circuses story in Batman, Shadow of the Bat number 85, which had a May 1999 cover date. The story is called Bread and Circuses, Conclusion. Written by Ian Edginton, with art by Disraeli or Disraeli. Letters, John Costanza. Colors, Disraeli and Digital Chameleon. Edits, Illidge, Gorfinkel, O'Neill. Cover price, $1.99. And something I didn't mention last time is that the Bread and Circuses covers are done by one of my very favorite artists, Ted McKeever. You don't usually see him on mainstream books. He's got a very... I don't even know how you would describe his style. I really, really enjoy it. It's like beautiful and ugly at the same time. He did like Metropole, Eddy Current. I think those came out for Marvel's Epic line, and then they were reprinted in hardcover as part of like Image's Shadow Line collection. I have a few of the volumes here behind me, and it's good stuff. I really, really enjoy the way he works. And he also did some of the Rachel Pollack Doom Patrol, the tail end of that volume in the Vertigo days. Really good stuff. Really really like his work here. So it was a pleasant surprise to see some McKeever covers here. It was pretty cool to see. Anyway, into the book here, and we pick up right where we left off. We got Batman on stage at Penguin's all-new, all-different Iceberg Lounge. And he declares to all that can hear him that this is still his city, and he is still the law around these parts. He then walks right up to the Penguin and punches him in the face, which breaks his nose. And this leads to some very annoying dialogue tics for the rest of the issue. Like, the Penguin's not going to be able to pronounce a lot of words with the busted proboscis. And I mean, it ain't Gambit and Rogue sort of annoying, but it's up there. Now, in order to reestablish himself in front of a large crowd, again, for the third time in as many stories, Batman challenges Ozzy's Heavy, the muscle machine Dozer. He says if he's able to beat him, then Ozzy's got to take care of the people in his territory. Feed them, put them to work so they can earn their keep without fear of being beaten up, sent to the wolves, or killed. To which Cobblepot kinda scoffs, because, I mean, come on. Of course Batman can beat up Dozer. It won't even be like a sporting sort of thing. He's Batman. But our baddie isn't so sure that Batman can beat up his entire gang. If he can, well, maybe Oswald will go along with Batman's demands. And so our hero accepts these terms and readies himself for many, 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 many fights. But first, how about we check in with the GCPD? Where Commissioner Gordon is rallying the troops for a full-on assault with the Wreckers and the Joza, I think. Now, Montoya pipes up to question this, stating that they're still licking their wounds from the last go-round with the gangbangers, and we saw that play out last issue with casualty. Gordon, well, he's steadfast on his decision, however. He claims that this is no time for the Blue Boys to risk losing face. Not only do they have laws to enforce, but... well, they need to be seen enforcing those laws. Foley, our friend Foley here, he mutters something about how many of them will die this time around. Gordon does like one of those passive-aggressive call-outs like, hey, you want to say that louder? You want to speak up? Who was that? Who was that? But before Foley can answer, Sarah Essen does. She reminds Jim that they are vastly outnumbered. And the commish, he is, I guess we can say oddly confident that this battle will end in their favor? Anyway, we wrap up this scene with another officer bursting into the room to inform the crew that there's something big going down at Penguin's place. Speaking of, let's head back over to the iceberg where Batman is in the middle of beating the hell out of Dozer. And as everybody predicted, it doesn't take long. Penguin, he's watching this all play out, but he's not worried at all. He refers to Dozer as nothing more than cannon fodder. All he sees is the coffers filling up with bets and wagers about how the night's festivities are going to wind up playing out. Worth noting, he's got himself a jar of Star Brand caviar, so I'm guessing one of his underground supply chains must lead to Marvel's new universe. From here, we hop over to Oracle's clock tower, where she's getting a bunch of tips on the movements of the many gangs of Gotham. She sees that they're all heading over to Penguin's new digs and wonders what sort of trouble Batman might have gotten himself into. Worth noting, we can see here that the new Iceberg Lounge is actually the fallen-over Davenport building from our Cataclysm and Aftershock stories, which is pretty cool. That's, of course, the one that Batman drove a bulldozer through. That's really cool. I wasn't expecting that. From here, we jump back to the GCPD as they head into enemy territory. And it's very quiet. Montoya notes how quiet it is. I mean, this is the territory of the Josa and the Wreckers. And since there's no noise, she fears an ambush. Gordon? He's not scared one bit. It's almost like he knows something. Because, well, we turn the page and see, well, a whole lot of dead gangbangers. It's like literally piles of bodies. And odder still, there's already a GCPD tag on the wall, which gives the Blue Boys full credit for this massacre. Bullock is completely gobsmacked. He's like, can't believe his eyes. Gordon is less so. Let's jump back to Batman, who spends the next few pages beating up the baddies. It's almost like a circus freak show of heavies here. We got the Penguin. He's chomping down on his caviar crackers and having a grand old time watching this all play out. All he sees are the bets rolling in, of which he gets 10% just for facilitating it, and he also sees his certainly soon-to-be-dead enemy entertaining the masses. Let's hop back to Commissioner Gordon, who's trying to unpack, well, a major load of guilt. He thinks to himself that he'd made a deal with the devil. He looks into a cracked mirror, and the reflection is of two faces. Another red herring? Maybe. Perhaps. Anyway, this guilt trip is interrupted by Sarah, who asks him to follow her back to the Blue Boys' war room, where everything seems to be coming up GCPD. Sarah tells him that, since this last outing, dozens of gangs are fallen in line and are fully willing to negotiate their territories lest they wind up suffering the same fates as the Josa and the Wreckers. To which Jim Gordon finally cracks a smile. That is, until he's handed a note that was left for him. This note reads, "Justice has been served. They were the first of many." So it would appear that the commish might have just created a monster he won't be able to control. Back to the lounge, where the Penguin is about to get some really inconvenient news. You see, during the last few bouts, the betting odds have changed. And they've changed drastically. The spectators and wagerers are now betting on Batman to win the day. Which, if that were to happen, that would cause Ozzy and company to lose everything. To which, Penguin stands up to call an end to the night's festivities. He attempts to throw everything out on a technicality. Because you see, fights at Penguins are normally to the death. And of course, we know Batman doesn't kill, so therefore, these bouts are now null and void. He blames Batman for ruining the patron's night and says that he'll void all bets, return all goods and monies, except for his 10%, of course. This news does not land well. Before long, the entire stage is swarming with angry No Man's Landers, all looking to take out their frustration on the big bad bird himself. Lucky for him, Batman is still there to wrangle everybody in line. He says if Ozzy's willing to play ball, he'll protect him. And you see, it's going to go down like this. Batman wants in on all the information that passes through the lounge, and he means all of it. He also wants the people in the Penguin's territory to be treated better. Ozzy can still put them to work, he doesn't care about that, so long as they're getting something out of it. Namely, food in their bellies and protection. To which Penguin, he's not happy, but he really doesn't have a choice, so he does agree to these terms. The people, well, they're still pissed off. One asks how anybody's going to stop them from getting their pound of flesh out of Cobblepot. And all Batman needs to do is smirk, and that's enough to get them tea kettles to settling. And with that, Batman vanishes. We close out with him returning to that nearby building where the new Batgirl's been keeping an eye on the Davenport. Now, she is quite nervous about all the activity going on. I mean, there are gangbangers swarming the Davenport. It's like a mob scene down there. But we close out with Batman having returned safely, and so everything's good. That's where we leave it. That's the end of Bread and Circuses. Next time out, we kick off a two-part Black Mask story called Mosaic in Batman number 565. But first, let's talk a little bit about this one. This was a really good issue. This was a really good issue. And of course, this is going with the... I'm not holding the fact that Batman had to perform in front of people for the third story in a row against it. Like I said, I don't know if there was some sort of mix-up. Maybe not even a mix-up, just not clarifying what order these stories were going to be published in. And so our first three authors all had the same idea. And it was a good idea that Batman needs to reestablish himself after a long absence in Gotham City. And they all did it, and they all made it seem like it was the first time, but we're not going to hold that against it. All three stories were good. But all three stories have something else in common as well. The Batman parts of them are among the weaker parts of them. Like this one here, it's Batman fighting a bunch of people. And that's really it. He's being scary Batman. He's beating people up and he's making threats. And I mean, of course, we're laying foundation. We're laying down rows of brick here to build upon, so it makes sense. It's just that all the Batman bits in these stories feel like, I don't want to say tacked on, but definitely lesser than the rest. Up to this point, I would say the stars of No Man's Land are the GCPD, Oracle, and Huntress, where Batman is just kind of there. He's just kind of there doing his thing. My main takeaway for this issue is definitely the commissioner and the GCPD here and whatever deal he made with whichever devil. And we do have, you know, we do have hints. Last time out, there was a lot of talk about jokes. This time, we see the two-faced reflection. He does say justice will be done, so or justice has been served. So I'm kind of leaning more toward Harvey, but I guess we'll see as we make our way through, because I do not remember this at all, which is pretty cool because it's like reading this for the first time. And I'm definitely looking forward to seeing how Jim Gordon navigates all this here, because clearly, I don't know if he's being irrational now. Rationality is a weird one. It's a weird weird word to define. There's a lot of different ways to define that when you dig into psychology. So perhaps he's being technically rational, but certainly wrong-headed and short-sighted at the same time here. I don't know if it's an ego thing or if it's a self-preservation sort of thing, because there is that one voice. There is that one voice in the GCPD bullpen there. Foley is not shy about calling Gordon out on his crap. And this time out, Gordon all but assured that he'd come out looking real good, you know? And perhaps that's a way to silence naysayers or to re-embolden or further embolden those who are already supporting him. But it's something that he's going to have to deal with before long. And I'm definitely looking forward to seeing some of those scenes. Just the taste we got here with him standing before the broken mirror thinking like, what did I just do? That was enough to really, you know, get me hyped for, you know, further visits into Gordon's psyche. That was definitely the highlight for me and the main takeaway for this two-parter. But I think that's probably all I got to say about this one for now. Of course, I look forward to hearing any of your thoughts about this story and about the entire run so far. Speaking of which, how about we hop into the NML bag here? We got a couple of letters. I'm going to start with our good friend Chris Yu talking about the closing chapter of, what was it called? I was going to say Feast or Famine. No, it was Fear of Faith. A lot of F words. He says, my takeaway from this issue is that Batman and Gordon are not on the same page. They seem to still have respect for each other, but they don't fully trust each other anymore. And that's totally true here, and you know, Batman probably doesn't know how little he should trust Jim Gordon here, which is interesting because we can, you know, we can see on the face of it why Gordon wouldn't trust Batman. Batman disappeared when his city and his people needed him the most. He, poof, you know, into the wind, he's gone. So it's going to take some doing for Batman to win back Gordon and the city's trust, respect, and fear. And we've seen him, you know, try to do that several times so far. Batman doesn't know that Gordon is making... I mean, he might know that he's making some bad decisions. Maybe some reckless decisions. Maybe some decisions that put his, put his team at risk, fatal risk. But he doesn't yet know about the deal with the devil. And maybe he never will, because, again, I don't remember this story. So Batman might never know about that. That might just be a secret that Gordon keeps to himself until one of the multiple times the universe has been rebooted. But we shall see. But your point is well taken here, for sure. Chris continues, I enjoyed the fact that this arc was more of a Huntress story than a Batman story. He's always in the background, but she was the star of this arc. I remember Huntress having a transformative story running through all of No Man's Land, and I'm enjoying watching it unfold. And that's totally true, and I should have read this message before doing our little talking time there, because you totally hit the nail on the head. Like I mentioned a few moments ago, these first three stories have been stories about other people. You know, Batman happens to be a part of them, but they're certainly not his stories. And I definitely agree that Fear of Faith was a Huntress story. For sure. Huntress was front and center. She was the one cutting the deals. She was the one busting the skulls. She was our point of view character, and I think the story was better for that. Because, honestly, I feel like Batman needs to re-earn his spot. You know, and I've joked about him doing this over and over again so far, but, like, you ever work for somebody who would, like, disappear from the office all the time, so you were left having to, like, carry the load on your shoulders, you carried the weight of whatever business you were working on or working in on your shoulders here. You were dealing with all the customers, you were dealing with all the inventory, you were dealing with everything. And, you know, people would come to you because you were the only one there. I feel like that's what Huntress has been so far. And then the boss comes back. You know, they pull up in their nice car and all of a sudden everybody forgets about you, the one who carried the load, and they go right to the boss because they're the boss. And the boss slips right back into being in control of everything, and they start questioning what you're doing and what you've done. That's kind of, that might be oddly specific, and I apologize for that, but that's the vibe I get. You know, Huntress has maintained order in her part of Gotham. She hasn't left. She hasn't wavered. She's been keeping as much in line as possible. And then Batman swoops in, and suddenly it's the Batman show again. And Huntress has to kind of defer to his, you know, this being his city. This is his city, these are his people, so he gets to take point. And so I like that Huntress got a story here. And Huntress, as Chris pointed out here, is going to get more stories. It's going to be, as he puts it, transformative. That's a very good word for it, for sure. That's a, you know, really, really fun and interesting topic, and I thank you so much for raising it here, Chris. I really, really appreciate it. Next, we're going to talk to our friend Professor Allen, who says, I've thoroughly enjoyed this extended conversation on comic book terminology. I love the point that CJ made recently, differentiating between literary conversations and general chit-chat. Yes, digging deep and arguing about terminology is appropriate, in certain context, that is. My academic expertise is in business and finance, so I get plenty of questions from friends about things like inflation, the stock market, taxes, etc. But before I answer, I need to quickly assess the type of answer they're really looking for. Is it the breezy 10-second answer, the slightly nuanced 60-second answer, or the serious, we need to sit down for this sort of conversation? The context determines the answer I give. Same question, but different answer. In other words, not everyone needs the, well, actually, answer. It's a stereotype that geeks are not always the best at picking up these social cues. Not all of us all the time, but many of us often. As I say, it's a stereotype because it's often true. I try to keep in mind that not everybody needs me to correct them every time. Maybe they're being friendly or asking a simple question, and I should respond accordingly. I love this forum for discussion. Keep up the good work. Well, thank you so much. There's a lot to unpack. Well, there's a lot and a little to unpack there, because Everything you say is absolutely true. And like you say, we don't always pick up social cues. And I feel like comic fans, and I mean fans of anything, we kind of fall into that bubble. You know, we fall into the bubble where we have our go-to answers for things. We have our go-to sort of, you know, I don't know how to even word it. I don't, and I've had these conversations, of course, but it's like, there's that saying that knowledge is power, right? Knowledge is power. And when we get hung up on terminology, like so many of us do, and I do especially, the well actuallys kind of just come, right? And it's hard to turn that off. It really is hard to turn that off. And I don't know if it's, you know, I hate using terms like gatekeeping because gatekeeping has been weaponized. I've mentioned that before. I feel like if we invest a lot of time into our hobby and our interests and our passions, then we have a right to be proud of our knowledge, you know? But not to the detriment of our humanity and our, like, you don't want to be the person that people wouldn't want to be stuck on an elevator with. And I think, speaking personally, I know I can be that guy. I know I could be that guy. I think that's common among we folk, where like it's a constant contest to out obscure each other to prove we know just a little bit more than our peers. And I think that's where the root of the terminology arguments might come from, or it might stem from, at least for me. I mean, using the example that I gave not too long ago, where, you know, I'm digging through 50 cent bins and a teenager walks by and like turns their nose up at comic books, but they love graphic novels. And that kind of thing, it just gets under my skin. It's pedantic for sure, and it's precious, absolutely. It's hard to turn that off. And you know, you mentioned that this is a forum for these sort of discussions, which it kind of floors me that, I mean, we're having these really fun discussions. We're all of similar mind, in as far as our fandom and our passion. And I remember like going to blogs back in the day, like Not Blog X was one that I would go to back in the very long ago. And that had a very active, a comment section where like inside jokes were there, and all like the Paul O'Brien stuff. I would go to him all the time, and they would be like inside jokes and comments on things that were talked about before. And they almost had their own lingo. And I remember sitting there like in awe reading that because this actually seemed like a round table, you know? And I never in a million years would have imagined that I'd be seated at one ever, like even just as part of the conversation. So the fact that we are having these discussions and we're having fun and we're exchanging ideas and we're trying to temper ourselves so we don't take ourselves too seriously. It means so much to me. It's hard for me to even put into words what it means to me that we have these conversations, that these conversations are happening to begin with, and the fact that I'm a part of them is almost unbelievable to me. So it means the world that we get to do this here, and or I get the opportunity to participate in these discussions. It's just so cool. And I think I still have so much to learn about our hobby and just being a human in it. Because what you said about having discussions about your expertise with other people, it rings so true. Because I mean, I don't have expertise in anything important. I really don't. I used to. Maybe I will again someday, but right now I don't. So the only kind of knowledge, quote unquote knowledge, that I can impart on people is we talk about context, right? Now, we're living in an age where people don't really care about comics, but they love comic book characters because of the movies. So those are the questions that I get all the time. It'll be like, oh, how true to the comic was this movie? To which I have to, like, say I didn't see the movie because I don't see the movies. But then it's almost like a knee-jerk sort of, like, not so much disgust, but more just like, just a general disgruntledness that people are getting their quote-unquote comic knowledge from movies. So that's when I become the, you know, a-hole actually guy, which I really need to be better about. Because, like you say, people are being friendly, or they're daring to show an interest in something I might know about. How dare they? So yeah, I probably ought to try to be a little bit better about stuff like that. Because once I get going, it's like I don't even see people's eyes glaze over and I just keep going. And I mean, there are literally thousands of hours of me talking into a microphone on the internet, so that should be no surprise that I just keep going on and on and on, beating subjects to death. So I could only imagine how it is when I'm face-to-face with folks. But at the end of the day, I'm still every which way but floppy. that's my one hill that I will probably one day die on. No more floppies. But I can't thank you enough, Alan, for this email here. It really, really meant a lot to me. So thank you so, so much. But that'll do it for our mailbag for today. And of course, if you'd like to be part of the conversation, I encourage and invite you to do so. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, chrisandreggie.podbean.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, and all the social media places that I forget to mention. But I think that's going to do it for me for today. I'd like to thank you all so much for being a part of this with me. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, start.